So I've decided to give this talk a title, Our Beautiful Brokenness. And I wanted to get that out there because I have a lot of appreciation for our recording volunteers who sometimes have to come up with the titles themselves, so I thought I'd make their job easy. As to whether I actually talk about that tonight, I'm not sure. We'll see how we go. But I wanted to start tonight. I came in here this evening and I bumped into a lot of people who I've known for a short time or often for a long time. And I wanted to start by expressing my very heartfelt gratitude to those people. Not sure I can name them all, but I think you know who you are. And the reason I wanted to do that is because I remember 23 years ago I came to this place, and it was to set in place a large number of changes in my life. I would say that learning about Buddhism, the Dhamma, has not only saved my life, it's helped me to live a life of inner quality. And I have a tremendous amount of appreciation, obviously for the Buddha, who was the original teacher, and for the Sangha, but also for the many, many people who have made this place possible through their donations, through their efforts, through their generosity of their time. I mean, it's a wonderful thing that those people have given their time, and I do often reflect upon that, and it is something that really delights me to think about the goodness of those people and their generosity. And that's something that keeps me going. As you heard in the introduction, I've spent a good many years on the committee, and sometimes I get very busy and stressed and I wonder, why do I do this? But deep down I know the answer is because I have a sense of appreciation and gratitude for all that I've been given, and I feel that I want to be part of giving back. And I want to say a sense of appreciation to everybody who's turned up here tonight. You know, it is so easy. There's things in life that are easy to do, but we have to ask ourselves whether they're worthwhile. And I'll just tell a short story in relation to that. I was a monk at Bodhinyana many years ago, and I remember one time we had a visit from a monk from the northeast of Thailand. His name was Ajahn Tan. He was a very had a very austere reputation. His monastery had no electricity or running water. He wasn't the kind of monk that messed around. It was 100% gung-ho practice. And I remember one night he gave a talk to the monks there, and he was having his talk translated by an American monk. And he was quite an animated and intense speaker. He would speak quite quickly. And he would go la da 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 in Thai, and then all of a sudden he'd say, easy but troublesome. He'd say it in English, so it cut through, and he knew exactly what he was talking about. And he was talking about the things in our lives, you know, there's lots of, his words were convenient but troublesome, and there are so many things that we have in our lives that we think are convenient and easy to do, but actually, they're the kind of things that can get us into a little bit of trouble. Okay, so we've all cut corners, or we've all said, okay, no, I'm going to eat healthy now, but you know, it's just so easy to have a snack or to have. Those are the things that are easy to do. But he would also then go on and talk about practice, and then he'd cut in English, he'd say, troublesome, but easy. And the point there was, you know, sometimes the practice is difficult. It requires effort. It requires us to put those things that can be easier to do to one side, and to devote ourselves to doing something that is troublesome in the beginning. And I know when I came here 23 years ago, I came here because I was looking for a book, and it was a very deep philosophical treatise by a monk in the Middle Ages, Nagarjuna. It's the treatise on emptiness. And I found the book, I was very happy, and then it was time for meditation, so I came in here. And that changed things, and I never did get around to reading that book. But I know when I found out about meditation, I was like, okay, this is it. this is going to be the way I'm going to fix myself. You know, because I was, well, I had a lot of problems. I was depressed. I was, you know, I was pretty messed up kind of person. And I thought, that's it. I'm going to fix myself. I'm going to meditate really hard. And then I'm going to get rid of all these problems in my mind, all this depression, and I'm just going to have emptiness. And then it'll be, everything will be perfect. So, you know, I imagined in my mind, that when the Buddha sat down under the tree to that night when he became enlightened, that he just put all this effort into his meditation. He tried really hard. And so I sat very hard and intensely concentrating, and I got a headache. I don't think I got that much closer to feeling happy, relieved, or perfect. In fact, I think possibly I felt subjectively as if I went backwards. But when that, and the truth is that I did take a step forward, I just didn't feel like it at the time. But that kind of leads me to where I want to go with tonight's talk. Usually when I give a talk, I'm talking about something I don't know about, but tonight I thought I might start by talking a little bit about something I do know about, which is culture and society. I teach social sciences. I'm quite obsessively interested in things like history and politics and sociology and so forth. And one thing I'm going to ask you to do just for a moment is to imagine you're an anthropologist from another planet coming down to Earth and view our society as if you're an outsider. And one of the things, if, even before you talk to anybody, one of the things you'll notice is, for instance, the buildings. And our buildings are, they're really quite something, you know. They're, you know, straight lines, symmetry, you know, even this hall, you know, there's a certain sense of majesty about it. And that's not to speak of the big buildings we have in Perth with shiny glass. Our Western society likes things to be neat and to be majestic, to look really good. And I think, you know, that tells you a little bit about our culture. And I don't want to be too critical about Western culture, but I want to get to a certain point of criticism of it. And I say that as a Westerner, because it has a huge influence on us. And, you know, not only do we, you know, the point I'm getting at is we aspire to for things to be grand and to look good and to be perfect. And we don't just want the things out there, you know. We don't just want to have a nice car and a house and to have a holiday which is just right and the lawn is mowed just neatly. It's not just that we intrinsically have that kind of push to make things orderly and I guess perfect, for want of a better word. We impose that upon ourselves. We impose that idealism, perhaps better than the word perfection, idealism. We have an ideal of how our lives should be and how we should be, how we should look and how we should behave, and, you know, what kind of job we should have. And we go to great lengths. And this is, you know, I don't say this out of a sense of negativity or blame. You know, I'm that person too. And when I came here and I started meditating, that's what I did. I tried to make my meditation perfect. I tried to make my mind perfect. And I failed. And I was very disappointed about that for a while. But I kept on trying. And that's an important point. I don't say that out of a sense of criticism. I do say it out of a sense of I want you to be mindful of that tendency. You know, the other thing about Western culture is we're told that we're individuals and we're unique and we can think for ourselves and stuff. But of course, that's just not true. We're actually very easily influenced. I mean, if we were really individuals who thought for ourselves, advertising wouldn't exist, would it now? But the truth is we're very easily influenced. You know, advertisers know this. You know, I've got a Buddhist friend who works in copywriting, and he once told me, he says, yeah, this job's really easy. you know, advertising. He said there's only seven things that you need to know to, you know, in order to appeal to people. You know, greed, lust, avarice, you know, seven deadly sins, basically. And, it, you know, we are easily influenced, but we're not just easily influenced in negative ways. We're also influenced in positive ways. And I think that's a very important point. That's why I started by expressing a sense of appreciation towards all of you, because one of the most precious gifts that we have on our spiritual path is good company and good people. You know, they support us, you know. And going back to that point about, you know, the fact that we're easily influenced and we're not really individuals, you know, I can see that the good qualities that I've developed over many years, you know, I'd like to take credit for those things, but the truth of the matter is I've been positively influenced by people like you. You've all given me something, some more than others, obviously, because I know some of you quite well. And I've been influenced by the Ajahns, by the teachers. Ajahn Brahm used to say to the monks in the monastery, I'm sure he still does say it, and he was actually quoting his own teacher, Ajahn Chah. He would say, here are these trees, here are these huts. You know, it's like you're in an orchard. Go sit under the tree and wait for the fruit to drop. And one sense, what he's saying is, you're in the right place. You've got the right conditions. It just takes time for it to come to fruition. And that's really where we're at as well. We just need to put ourselves in the right place with the right influences. And obviously, wise teachers is a very important part of that. And the path just starts to unfold because we are easily influenced. And then all of a sudden we find that we're putting effort into the practice, and things start to change, and we get some positive results. We get a little bit more peace, a little more calmness, a bit more wisdom, and a bit more happiness, and that inspires us to take the next step. Okay. But going back to my story about, and I'm maybe others have been here. I mean, I think some of you maybe are wiser than me. Maybe you started off meditation and you just followed the instructions. I had a lot of trouble following the instructions, you know, this whole thing about letting go, and I just know it was going to be me doing the meditation. I was going to get there. And I didn't see early on in my practice, and I wasted a lot of time trying to make my mind a certain way. And I think we're all inclined, because, you know, in our lives, that's what we're told, you know. You go to school, be good, study hard. Then you can go to university or, you know, get a good job, and then you can do this. And, you know, through your efforts, you know, you will make your life good. That's the message. But what I discovered when I started meditating was that often my efforts got in the way. It took me a long time to learn to start letting go. And when I did let go, wow, then things really started to change. And that was a powerful lesson. But I think one of the things that I've discovered over a long period of time is that Buddhism and Buddhist culture is coming from quite a different place compared to Western culture. As I said before, Western culture is idealistic. It's trying to make things orderly and magnificent and impressive. And Buddhism is just trying to accept things as they are. And that's kind of weird for the Western way of thinking. And the truth is, where we fall a long way short of our expectations. And that alone can be the cause of so much of our unhappiness. Buddhism teaches about suffering, and there's suffering which occurs in the body, and you know, it's sickness and aging and death, and these things are inevitable. But if you actually look at your subjective experience, what's going on in your mind, especially when you start to suffer, most of the time it's not about your body. Sometimes it is. Most of the time it's because you didn't get what you wanted, or you got something you didn't want, something you really cared about is broken or gone away. If you actually look at the things that we obsess about and turn over in our minds when we're suffering, it's because things in our lives have gone away that we didn't want them to go. It's because life is not fitting in with our preferences. That's, when you understand that, that's a really, really powerful point of understanding, is to understand that it's very hard to not have craving. It's not something that you can just flick a switch and, you know, you'll be at peace and have no craving. We are conditioned. We are here, we're born as human beings because we chose to at some level, but we've got a craving for things. But that craving is also the source of our suffering. So this creates a paradox. When you come to understand this, well, what do I do? Okay. But the point I wanted to get at was, we want, at some level, things to be in some sort of ideal, to fit in with some kind of dream. You know, we want our house to be a certain way. We want our relationships to be a certain way. We want our job to be a certain way. We want our holiday to be a certain way. We have an idea, and this is where the idealism stems from. But if we actually look at how things are, we often get a little bit disappointed because things are a bit messed up. They're not necessarily terrible, but they're not quite right. You know, that, you know, our relationship, you know, it's got that niggling little problem with it. You know, our job is, you know, we don't mind it, but, you know, there's these people who are really difficult to deal with, and there's this problem, you know. Like, I'm a teacher, I like teaching, but all the marking I have to do, it's so hard. We've all got this experience. But here's a thought. What if we just accepted it for what it is? What if we just said, well, okay, it's not perfect, but I can still accept it for what it is. What if we can accept our partners? Well, they're not perfect. They can be a bit of a nuisance sometimes, but they're really very good people. They do a lot. They try very hard. Yeah, I can accept them. What if we could say to ourselves, yeah, I'm not perfect. I stuff things up, you know, all the time, really, truth be told. But that's okay. I'm trying. I'm trying to do the right thing. Yeah, I can accept myself. What if we took that new perspective? A few months ago, I came across a new, I don't know how to describe this. I think it's an attitude. I'm not sure if that's the right word. It's an attitude or an idea or a perception. It comes from Japanese culture, and I'm definitely deeply influenced by Buddhism. I could tell straight away. And it's this idea of wabi-sabi. And wabi-sabi is, it's an appreciation for how things are. And one of the things you'll notice if you've ever seen, like, for instance, a Japanese garden, and you compare it to, say, a European garden, you know, European garden, nice, neat edges and hedgerows, and everything looks neat and orderly. Japanese garden's not like that. It's a bit of a mess. There's curves. If you've seen a bonsai tree, it's kind of crooked, and you know what I mean? It's all over the place, right? And yet it's beautiful. And I was thinking about that. I think it really applies. I'm very fortunate. I live up in the hills, in the forest, and I really like the Australian bush. And if you've walked around in the Australian bush, the thing you'll notice about it is it's a mess. You know, the trees are all crooked. You've got these big gnarly bits hanging off the tree. You've got broken branches. You've got, it's really, it's chaotic. And it's beautiful. It's really, truly very beautiful. And if we take the time and we let go of all our thinking and our worries and our troubles and we go out in nature, we can see the beauty in that nature. And that perception, that attitude of it's imperfect, it's crooked, and it's beautiful is a really, I think it's a really excellent attitude. And for me, it was starting to understand that, which helped me to begin that process of not trying to change myself, of accepting who I am, accepting the people around me, because I'll admit it, I was a control freak. I tried to change other people and make them fit in with my preferences, change my environment, change myself. You know, I had high hopes for myself. I've been a very big disappointment. And that's fine. Because once I started to let go of those expectations and develop an appreciation for all that I have in my life, for the people who've supported me, and for myself, all of a sudden there was a sense of peace that came into my life. And I think that's something that we can all do. So if we can take that attitude of wabi-sabi, it's broken and it's beautiful. You know, I think there's a good argument for you to have a sense of appreciation for yourself. I'm not talking like, you know, being egoistic and saying what a great person you are and you achieved this and you did that and you... No. I'm talking about the fact that, you know, you went through difficulty, you strived, you stuffed some things up, and you kept on trying. You are a person, everybody here is a person who is trying to be good, trying to find happiness. Everyone here is on a spiritual path. Give yourself some credit. That's a beautiful thing. You've come so far already. Can you see the good in that? So it's about when we've got that sense of idealism, like it's got to be this way, it's got to be that way, it's got to be just right, there's a sense of intolerance that comes with it. But when we start to turn it around and say, well, yeah, okay, I'm kind of imperfect, the situation's not great, it's kind of a bit messed up, but hey, that's okay. And then turn it around and say, actually, it's more than okay, it's beautiful. And having that sense of appreciation for the good. You know, it might be that you tried and you messed it up a little bit, but there was always that good intention there, and that I think makes it beautiful. Or even, you know, maybe you did stuff something up completely. But hey, you can learn from that. I think one of the things that if you've been coming along here and learning from the Ajahns for a while, I think one of the things you start to pick up on is that really so much of our experience is made up by our perception. And we might not be able to control the world, but we have a choice about how we perceive what happens. I think we've all had that kind of experience. A couple of years ago, I woke up one day, it was a normal day like any other. I had to go to work. My ear was blocked. You know, some people get it, you know, they get wax in their ears. So it's a bit annoying, I'm gonna have to go see the doctor about that. So I went through my day, went to work, teaching classes, pretty normal day. Got to lunchtime. All of a sudden I felt dizzy. And I was having trouble walking in a straight line. And it got worse. So the next day I had to take off work and I went to the doctor. And by that stage, I was finding it difficult to stand up. I was so dizzy. And the doctor said, yeah, you've got an inner ear infection. And if it doesn't get better in the next couple of days, that's it. You've lost your hearing and your balance. This wasn't part of my plan. We've all had something happen to us like that, right? We were just going along, pursuing what we were trying to get done, regular life, and there's something intervenes. A tragedy, illness, whatever. And I know that my initial response was one of, oh no, what? What does this all mean? And it was a hard, and it was confusing because my head was spinning all the time. It was like being seasick, but I wasn't moving. But it took me a day or two and I finally came around and I realized, well, it is what it is. I'm broken. And I never did get my hearing back. My balance came back. But my hearing didn't. I can only hear in one ear now. And that's the way it is. I'm broken. But we're all broken a little bit, aren't we? But as soon as I could accept it, everything changed. I wasn't fighting it anymore. I wasn't in trying to push it away, that experience, this negative experience of illness. I was able to say, okay, I can work with that. Okay, maybe I can learn from this. I think that is a very powerful perception which we can all, you know, at some point in time we're going to have some pretty bad stuff happen to us. I mean, sorry, it is going to happen. But how bad it is really up to us. If we push it away and deny it and try to fix it all up and make it perfect again, often the suffering just gets worse. But when we get to that point and say, you know what, you know, I got a good 40 years out of that ear. I made the most of it whilst I could. I listened to a lot of really good music. It's up to us how we're going to view this. Okay? There's definitely another way of looking at it. And I think that is a radically different way of seeing things. You know, according to the Western view of things, you know, we are just a body. And, you know, this is it. This is the one life. You know, have fun. Make the most of it. Have fun. Do what you want. But, you know, if you're taking a Buddhist point of view, obviously, we understand that there is a body, but there's also a mind. And what happens in our mind is really, really important. So, okay, we all like to have pleasant feelings through our body. We like to eat nice food and see movies or nice art, or we like to have those pleasant senses in our experience, in our physical experience. But far more powerful than that is our subjective mental or emotional experience. And I think in some ways it's a bit of a shame that more people don't understand that the fundamental nature of reality is not one, not singular, but dual. There is a body, but there is also a mind. And the most important part of that equation is the mind. That is where we can potentially create happiness. Now, we don't create happiness through, you know, like my misguided efforts of meditation. Sit down, put your tongue on the roof of your mouth and just push, push, push. You know, a lot of it is actually about how we see the world and how we interact with the world and how we interact with ourselves. And the quality of our lives is very much determined by that. So that's one part of the equation, but also understanding that, you know, at some point, yes, this body, it's going to die. But the mind will continue. Now, when you understand that, which one should you put more effort into? Now, I'm not suggesting that you shouldn't look after your body. You know, it's here, you might as well look after it, otherwise you're going to have problems. But at the end of a lifetime, that's it, it's gone. You have to say goodbye to the body, but whatever you've done with your mind, whatever you've generated with your mind, you're taking that with you, for better or for worse. If you develop anger and craving and greed, that's what's going to go with you, and all the suffering that entails. But if you've generated kindness, generosity, calmness, wisdom, those are the things that you'll take with you. So it's very well worth putting effort into that. You know, people say, you know, when they come and practice Buddhism, they say, oh, you know, it's a nice thing, you know, I'd like to get enlightened, but it's so much effort, it's not for me. You know, it's just too much effort. Okay, well, probably to get all the way to nirvana and be enlightened, yeah, it probably is a fair bit of effort over a period of time. I don't know because I'm not there yet. I've put in quite a bit of effort. I'm still not there. So I'll assume that takes quite a bit of effort. But then I see people, you know, they do things in their lives. Like, for instance, take Olympic athletes. That's a tremendous amount of effort, isn't it? Don't you think about it? Think about all the hours they put in for training. I mean, we can kind of admire their effort, can't we? You know, their dedication, and then they go and they run a race or they do this and it's all over. What if we were to put that kind of gold medal effort into developing our inner qualities? Where would we be at if we did that? And perhaps the one other thing I want to mention now, I just got back onto talking about effort again, but the right effort, and this is the thing that took me a very long time to understand, the right effort isn't one of control and force, it's the effort of letting go, of accepting things as they are. Now sometimes that can be pretty tricky and pretty confronting, but that is the kind of right effort we're talking about. So it took me a long time to learn that factor of the Eightfold Path, right effort, wasn't about force and force of will, of control, of, you know, push, push, push. It was very much one of relinquishment, of letting go. And when I understood that, I thought, well, actually, this path isn't as hard as I first imagined. I don't need to control this path. I just need to, you know, be mindful and to learn as I go. You know, when I was younger, I had such big ideas and such big plans, and they haven't, you know, some of them have come to fruition and some of them haven't. But the truth of the matter is, I'm much happier than I expected I would be. So maybe I'm fortunate that I didn't achieve everything I set out to achieve. Often happiness comes to us in unexpected packages. And if we're not paying attention, we're still striving, like what John Lennon said, he says, you know, life's what happens when we're planning other things. If we are like that, often we don't see that opportunity for happiness or that positive thing that's coming our way because we're striving for this other thing. So, you know, that ability to be here and now can be a very powerful opening to opportunity to find happiness or learning in the here and now. Um, And I think that just going back to my theme about that sense of brokenness, I mean, that's something that Ajahn Chah used to do, and Ajahn Brahm says, you know, Ajahn Chah used to hold up a cup and say, do you see this? Yeah, it's broken. But it's not apparent. He said there's a tiny little crack in here, you can't see it. But one day, it's going to fall down, it's going to break. In other words, you may not feel like you're broken at this point in time, but the conditions for us to break are there. We don't know, and the reason I told you that story about my illness, which is, you know, it's not the worst illness you could possibly have, you know, there's people who get cancer and all sorts of things like that, but you don't expect it. It's like you're going on in your life, and then all of a sudden, what? I'm sick? I've got cancer? I've got this, I've got that, what? But actually, why not? Why not? You have a human body. Human bodies get sick. Do you want to be, I mean, how we feel about that is up to us. One of the things that struck me when I first started coming along and participating here, and taught the odd beginner's meditation class, you know, and I found it quite interesting. I mean, I'd been meditating for a few years, and then I was teaching people. Some of them did have cancer. And yet some of them would come back later and say, that was the best thing that ever happened to me. Sounds weird. But it wasn't the cancer that was the best thing that ever happened to them. It was that relationship, learning that new relationship with this difficult experience was the best thing that happened to them. Cancer was the catalyst. It was how they began, learned to relate to it in a new and positive way, to accept it. And to accept, yeah, I'm sick. It's okay. I can be at peace with that. So that attitude of acceptance, or perhaps going beyond just acceptance. Acceptance is that first stage, but going beyond it and just almost having an appreciation for that situation. So if you can view that crooked bonsai tree as beautiful, or you can go for the walk in the Australian bush up here in the Jarrah forests with all their crooked branches and hollowed out trunks and what have you, and you can view that as beautiful. Can you see the beauty in your imperfection? Can you see the beauty in the story of your life? You didn't get it all right, did you? But that's okay. Acceptance. It's beautiful. It's that sense of love and kindness, of seeing the beauty in that situation. It's a very powerful perception, which I think is very much in line with the Buddhist teachings, because it's not about changing the world out there. It's about changing the way we relate to the world. Rather than not accepting and being intolerant towards the things that you think are going wrong, it's a sense of being at peace, of acceptance, of kindness, of appreciation for what's going on. It's a very, very different attitude, but it's one that can lead us into a state of calm, a state of peace. And therefore, I think it's an attitude or a perception that's very well worth cultivating. So next time you have an illness, next time you make a mistake, next time something goes wrong, you know, we are conditioned, of course, to potentially react negatively, but can we catch ourselves when those negative reactions arise and then turn it around and see the situation and see ourselves and the circumstances of life in a new way? Can we do that? That's the challenge I'm setting for you. It's not one of effort and force, it's one of relinquishment and just going, I don't need to change the world. I can accept it as it is. I can see the beauty of it as it is. Yeah? And I think that's a very different attitude, and extending it further, I mean, obviously, you know, the Western attitude has transformed the world. Yes, we have beautiful gleaming buildings, but we also have problems with pollution and the damage we've done to the natural environment. And maybe the new attitude that we need to adopt is one of not requiring to build those large buildings, but to preserve nature as it is and to preserve our nature as it is to some extent as well. So I offer that as a reflection, as a different way of looking at our personal circumstances, but also the circumstances of the world more broadly. No scheme will make the world perfect. You know, it is what it is, and it can be beautiful if we choose to see it that way. I think I'll wrap the talk up there, but if anybody does wish to ask a question or two, I'll just give an opportunity for anyone who does want to ask a question. I've got one over there. Yes, again.
I would like to know what your position is on livestock and meat eating.
Oh, that's a good question. Yeah. okay. Well, I'll give you my personal answer, and I'll let you decide what you want to believe. When I was 16, I chose to become a vegetarian, and I did that for a variety of reasons. But I thought that. Not just that it was unethical, but, you know, it was causing a lot of damage to the environment by raising animals and, you know, knocking down forests just to raise animals and so forth. So that was my view. And when I became a vegetarian when I was younger, I think I was very enthusiastic and I was also a little bit intolerant. So I liked to push my view onto other people. I'm a bit older now, and I'm a little bit more mellow about things. I think that it is very hard as a human being to not cause any harm. Our job as Buddhists is exactly that, to minimize as best we can, and not to kill is one of the best and easiest things that we can do. But we also need to look at the bigger picture. So whilst I choose to be a vegetarian, I don't push that onto anybody these days. Some people, I've known some people who need to eat meat for health reasons. And I can't judge them. I'm not in that situation. So I don't judge people. You know, and look, to give you some context, I'm a Buddhist. I've been Buddhist for 23 years. My wife's Catholic. And, you know, I don't tell my wife what she should eat or my son. And I think it's up to them. I think everyone needs to work it out themselves. I think I would encourage people to, you know, not harm animals and, yeah, maybe to adopt a vegetarian diet if you're able. But I wouldn't force it on anybody. I think it's also important to accept people wherever they're at. So I don't know if that really answers your question very well, but maybe it gives you... what I wanted to do is to like show you that there's two sides of it. So it's up to you what you're going to do. And if you're dedicated, you can refrain from causing harm in the world. And I've got to tell you one thing. When I was young, I was very idealistic, and I believed, you know, I used to be very into politics, and I used to believe, you know, this idea or that idea will make the world a better place. And then I heard an Australian monk, his name was Ajahn Yanadamo, giving a talk, and he said, you know, he also thought that when he was young. And then he realised that if everybody in the world kept one precept, the first precept, to not kill, what a different world we'd live in. And I realised at that point, all this ideology, you know, this ism and that ism, was not the answer. Ultimately, what creates a happy, peaceful, harmonious society is when people practice virtue, which includes things like refraining from killing. So if you can be that person who refrains from killing, you are offering a gift to the world, and that's a wonderful thing. But if we get ideological about it and dogmatic, then we can create conflict. So, yeah. Okay. Well, thank you. I've obviously given a very good talk, because there's no questions, so it's very clear. Thank you to me. Look, I know you want to get on, and it's a pretty stormy night out there, so I think we'll bow to the Buddha, and then I'll wish you all very well for your evening and your weekend.